This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this show, leading American scientist Virginia Burkett explains how a more violent climate could damage the fossil fuel infrastructure we currently count on. The controversial green activist Dave Foreman speaks out, Human Overpopulation versus the Wild. Then Sherry Coons on her book, Prefabulous and Almost Off the Grid. It's a triple header, and off we go. New reporting about climate impacts on coastal states in the United States suggests climate change could damage energy production and distribution in America, not to mention major interstate highways everyone takes for granted. Looking at hurricanes Katrina and Sandy, it's not hard to imagine storms could strangle the American economy for a while. We have an expert here to help us drill into this underreported story. Dr. Virginia Burkett is the chief scientist for climate and land use change at the U.S. Geological Survey. Before that, she served and studied in Louisiana's coastlands. Virginia was also a lead author in several reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Burkett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
A pleasure to be with you, Alex.
I spent a weekend going through a report you co-authored with the long title, Coastal Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerabilities, a Technical Input to the 2013 National Climate Assessment. There was so much content in there, so many different varieties of information, I almost gave up, Virginia, and then I realized, well, maybe that's the point. Climate change is going to disrupt so much of human life and other species. It's a subject almost beyond anyone's mortal understanding. Would you agree with that?
Beyond mortal understanding, not completely, because I believe that we have a fairly good understanding of the main causes of climate change and the influence of human activity that is unequivocal. I think that we understand how the current warming is different from the natural cycles of planetary warming and cooling in the geologic past.
Well, let's go to your old stomping grounds in Louisiana. How much of our energy infrastructure is found on the Gulf Coast?
Most of the nation's coastal and offshore infrastructure for energy exploration and development is located, and even import, is located in the Gulf Coast. Louisiana, for example, is the nation's largest state in terms of crude oil production, including onshore and offshore activity, and in the federal waters. Through time, energy development has migrated from inland areas in Louisiana in shallow water bodies to the offshore development into deeper and deeper water. And today there's about 4,000 oil and gas platforms located off the Louisiana and Texas coast today. And in addition to that basic infrastructure, there's thousands of miles of pipelines that bring the oil and gas that's developed offshore to onshore tank batteries, over 24 refineries, major refineries, and even the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserves that are located here in the Gulf Coastal Zone. The Gulf Coast also has the largest concentration of U.S. ports and infrastructure that receives and transports two-thirds of U.S. oil imports. The Loop facility off the Louisiana coast, for example, the Louisiana Deepwater Oil Port. And more than 90% of U.S. domestic offshore and onshore coastal oil and gas comes from the Gulf Coast. So the energy infrastructure is very prevalent if you fly across the landscape. There's, in addition to the energy infrastructure itself, there's 20,000 miles of highways, 61 airports, and that's just in the central Gulf Coast area where this oil and gas infrastructure is most prominent.
So if for any reason that goes down, New England goes cold and a lot of people stop driving, is that what we're getting to?
Well, and prices go up, and that's what you saw during Katrina.
Well, speaking of Katrina, during that coverage, we saw news stories about refineries flooded and leaking, but how serious was that for the U.S. energy industry?
Well, it was very serious. I live in Louisiana, and the impacts of Katrina on our coast, the coast itself, our energy facilities, and even our communities was very difficult to watch. My parents lost their home overnight, and many of our Gulf Coast communities are still struggling to regain their economic bases. And in Louisiana, the oil and gas industry is one of the largest coastal employers. But, you know, as we said earlier, the impacts of Katrina were not confined to the coast. The impacts of oil and gas production and transportation and the downtime on those facilities spread throughout our state, our nation, and even affected gasoline prices in other parts of the world.
And what did we learn? What can Katrina tell us about the possible impacts on our energy system during the next 50 years?
Well, in terms of our coastal, you know, we're just talking now about coastal energy systems. And, you know, the land that the energy systems are sitting upon or situated upon is at risk. During Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana lost 214 square miles of its coastal land. And that land loss, with the attendant impacts of Hurricane Katrina on energy infrastructure and the inundation of areas, we didn't lose the land permanently, but it was inundated and basically shut down for production or transportation or use, is just a glimpse of a future without adaptation and without mitigation for climate change.
Virginia Burkett, do you envision a series of big changes from violent storms like Katrina, or would it be a long grinding down from rising seas, or both?
Both.
Okay. And what would rising seas look like, even if we don't have the storms? What happens with that?
Well, the rising seas, of course, you know, much of the coastal zone in this part of the world is 2 to 4 feet above mean sea level. And so rising seas have not been the major driver of coastal change here in the past 100 years. But that sea level rise is accelerating and is likely to continue to accelerate. So through time, the role of sea level rise on flooding is expected to increase. In addition to the sea level rise and storms, you know, we're expecting to see changes in precipitation patterns and temperature that have implications for our coastal infrastructure. And the nature of those impacts, Alex, varies from one region to another. You know, in the Gulf Coast here, because of the low elevation, sea level rise and storm surge are the huge drivers of change. But in Alaska, which is another important producer of natural resources, you know, the warming temperature is the main driver of change. That's because as the sea ice declines through time, the coastline becomes more vulnerable to erosion. And that coastline is dominated by ice in the sediments, which is also declining. And so basically the coast is collapsing while sea level is rising and the sea ice is retreating. So they're having to evacuate communities from the coastline, and some of the energy production facilities there are vulnerable now to impacts that they wouldn't have been, you know, if the temperature hadn't risen so dramatically in that region.
Well, could you talk to us a little bit more about the highways and the coastal transportation systems? What did your technical report find in that area?
The technical report has just a couple of pages about transportation impacts, and many of those little facts that are presented there refer to another study that we did for the U.S. Department of Transportation. And, you know, in terms of Katrina's effect on transportation, that's the report I would refer people to, and the one done for the Department of Transportation. You know, yes, there was a breakdown in transportation. That's one reason they couldn't get people out of New Orleans. Also, we saw many other impacts and documented those impacts on highways and bridges. Bridges, for example, you know, there's about 8,000 bridges in the coastal area between Galveston and Mobile, this area where this is the energy hub there. But about 24 of those bridges were hit by wave surges from Katrina and caused serious damage. One of the bridges, the one over the Bay St. Louis in Mississippi, when they rebuilt that bridge, they elevated the bridge to a height above the storm surge during Katrina. So people are adapting to the changes that are underway here and that are projected, and partly in response to what happened during Katrina. Also during Katrina, other aspects of the transportation network were destroyed or affected. For example, after Hurricane Katrina, the CSX, the major rail transporter here, rerouted transportation. Their trains that previously passed through New Orleans up through St. Louis and Memphis. And there's talk about permanently moving these rail lines further inland, but that means they would be away from the coastal areas where most of the population lives, moving passenger rail service further away from these population centers. We also saw damage to ports, as evidenced by Katrina. Fast-moving water can cause incredible damage to marine facilities, dislodging containers and cargoes. We saw terminal buildings knocked down, damage to wharves and pier structures, and permanent inundation and loss of some pavement and foundations at ports. wind damage to metal warehouses. The Port of New Orleans, for example, you know, escaped water damage for the most part, but most of the damage there was due to the tearing off of warehouse roofs and doors. Well, let's stop there. I could go on and on about this, obviously.
It was a big, big blow. But, you know, hurricanes are pretty common to the Gulf of Mexico and the American South. Some of my listeners are going to be going, well, so what? Why do we attribute some of that damage to climate change?
Well, you know, you can't attribute a single storm or any single weather event to climate change. That would be, I mean, people, most scientists would never do that. You know, the trends in the intensity and the frequency of these weather events has been changing, though. And in the North Atlantic, we've seen an increase in the overall strength of hurricanes, particularly in the Category 5, 4 and 5 level hurricanes in the North Atlantic since the late 1970s, early 1980s. And most scientists believe that these increases are linked in part to higher sea surface temperature. You know, there's a complex relations between ocean temperature and hurricanes that we don't fully understand. But nonetheless, the intensity of the strongest hurricanes is projected to continue to increase as the oceans continue to warm.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Virginia Burkett. She is Chief Scientist for Climate and Land Use Change at the U.S. Geological Survey. We're talking about some impacts of climate change on the coastal economy and especially on the energy industry. Well, Virginia, what could be done by the oil and gas industry, for example, to alleviate the damage or to prepare for some of the threats we've been talking about?
Well, it's just like any other economic sector or even a coastal community. The energy industry can use the knowledge that is available about climate change to develop adaptation strategies across the board. They could range from elevating tank batteries to reinforcing platforms, even burying pipelines deeper, you know, in the shallow areas where hurricanes dislodged and ruptured pipelines in the past.
I know some of my listeners are thinking, well, they should just go into the solar industry instead and help prevent some of this damage, but we'll leave that. That's kind of political. When we move from the Gulf Coast to another busy and heavily populated coastal region, say Chesapeake Bay and its surrounding states, can you talk a little bit about some of the economic weak points there as we experience climate disruption?
Well, they're kind of similar to what we've seen on the Gulf Coast. You know, changes in sea level rise are already affecting the wetlands and the shorelines of the Chesapeake Bay area. In addition, we're seeing saltwater intrusion into some formerly freshwater areas. The occurrence of harmful algal blooms, which are a problem there, is associated with events of our summers where the water temperature gets real high. So, you know, we're likely to see more of that into the future as the air temperature rises. You're expecting to see higher water temperatures, particularly in these really shallow water bodies. And water temperature increases also increase the frequency of summer hypoxia, or the amount of oxygen that can be held in the water column that's needed for fish and shellfish. So, you know, effects not just on people and infrastructure, but also on natural species and species that are important commercially, like oysters and finfish.
Have you heard about some solutions or adaptation being proposed by those states?
Yes, in our report we have, and I really appreciate it. You said you might post the link to our report. There's a table in there of some of the adaptations that have been undertaken in the coastal states, but also for the Chesapeake Bay area, we have that as a case study at the back of our report, and we present there a lot of the impacts that are being expected or being seen there, and we refer people to the adaptation strategies that have been developed by the state of Maryland, for example. So there is in different counties, like the Baltimore City County Watershed has an action plan that can or benefit from understanding the experiences that are possibly related to climate and likely to be related to climate into the future.
You know, I've traveled the coastal highways through all the Gulf states. A lot of the roads seem to me like long bridges. It's hard to tell where the land stopped and the water began again, and it's hard to spot a big hill. It's difficult for me to imagine how states like Texas, Louisiana, or Mississippi are going to prepare for climate change. What have you heard about that?
Many of the coastal states have climate change assessments that they've conducted using a range of sea level rise scenarios and considering historical trends in rainfall patterns and storm surge levels and that sort of thing. So a lot of the coastal states have these adaptation strategies that they've built on top of these assessments of impacts. Other states are actually incorporating the knowledge of climate change into their coastal management programs and their coastal protection strategies. For example, in Louisiana, they have a coastal protection master plan. It's called the 2012 Master Plan, and they have two levels of sea level rise, one more modest and one that's, you know, along the lines of what you'll see in our report as the high end. And for every project that they have outlined to be conducted in coastal Louisiana, they evaluated the cost and the benefits based upon two different levels of sea level rise. So they don't get into great detail about the causes of climate change or mitigation or anything like that. They're just practically using the science that they have faith in, and there's quite a consensus about, you know, sea level rise accelerating. So they've used that science in the design of their coastal protection master plan.
Well, as I said, I've been looking at the report you co-authored, Coastal Impacts, Adaptation and Vulnerabilities, and that was a technical input to the 2013 National Climate Assessment. I will put a link to that report in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Virginia Burkett, what happens to that report now?
The report was written by 79 people, including myself, scientists and engineers. Some people from the Corps of Engineers helped write it. And the report was written to underpin the coastal chapter of the third National Climate Assessment for the United States. And indeed, when that chapter was drafted, this report is what they cited very frequently. And some of our key findings are in that report. Our report, this longer report, is almost 200 pages. And the chapter on coast in the national assessment will end up probably being only 10 to 15 pages. So they didn't have room to bring in everything, but they did rely largely on the consensus of the 79 scientists and engineers that drafted our report.
Is there other research you would like to tell us about?
You were interested in transportation. And I'll give you a link to the report that we did about transportation infrastructure and the effects of climate change in this Gulf Coast, the Central Gulf Coast region. So that might be an important thing for you to have. The other thing I would point out to your listeners is that a draft of the national assessment has been posted on the web for public comment. And the authors will take those public comments, and I believe the public comment period ends on April the 12th. So you can download one of the 30 chapters. I wouldn't download the whole thing. It's 1,100 pages long. But you could download the chapters that you're interested in, review them, and then online you can submit comments, whether you're a scientist or a policymaker, or if you see something, you know, that's just a blatant omission, you know, that should be brought to the attention of the authors. So I can send you that link as well if you'd be willing to post it.
Yes, we can even sequester more in the soil by changing our agricultural methods, so that's another way to go. You have been listening to Dr. Virginia Burkett, one of America's leading climate scientists and chief scientist for climate and land use change at the U.S. Geological Survey. Virginia, I appreciate you giving up some valuable time to talk with us. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Please remember, the views expressed by our guests may not reflect my own or those of this radio station. Talk about immigration or controlling population growth, and get ready to dodge the bricks tossed your way. Our next guest is no stranger to controversy. He started out in the 1970s New Mexico working with conservation groups, seeing that movement kind of fail. At the start of the Reagan presidency, Dave Foreman and friends founded the group symbolizing radical green action. They called it Earth First. Foreman published Eco Defense, a field guide to monkey wrenching. In 1990, Dave had a brush with the FBI about an Arizona power line, but he was never directly involved. Since then, Foreman co-founded the Wildlands Project and wrote the book Rewilding North America, A Vision for Conservation in the 21st Century. Dave Foreman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to get a chance to finally meet you, at least a little bit on the telephone. You know, as the Grateful Dead would say, what a long, strange trip it's been. Are we still somehow on the same road we began with on Earth Day in 1970?
I really think that Earth Day 1970 has been overplayed. The conservation that I'm really a part of, wilderness and wildlife, had its beginnings much earlier and really was quite little affected by Earth Day. I think Earth Day led more to a lot of excitement about environmentalism, which I differentiate from conservation, and controlling pollution, making cities more livable, and that sort of thing. And in that way, it did a heck of a lot of good. But I think it's a little different than, at least in the United States, than the conservation movement was.
Well, who are the earlier writers in the conservation movement that you would identify with then?
Well, you can go back to Henry David Thoreau and John Muir, others like Aldo Leopold, Ernest Thompson Seton, Olaus Murray, Bob Marshall, others like that. They were most interested in how to protect the fading away wild places in North America, and also the fading away wildlife. In the 19th century, we had seen the horrible events of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, which ranged from Florida to Ontario and was the most abundant bird on Earth. And in 20 years after the United States Civil War, the passenger pigeon was extinct in the wild. It had been overhunted, and its habitat had been cut down. And that was quite a shock. The same thing nearly happened to the bison on the U.S. and Canadian prairies, with some 50 million bison being slaughtered in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s, to where there were fewer than 1,000 bison left in Canada and the United States by 1890. And those two things really launched the conservation movement, along with the heavy logging that had gone on in the eastern United States and other exploitation of the land.
Well, speaking of John Muir, in 1997, you were on the board of directors of the Sierra Club. Why did you leave?
I left in part because I was frustrated with the Sierra Club turning its back on the population issue. That in 1989, the Sierra Club, I thought, had taken a very respectful and solid position on population freezing in the United States, recognizing that most of the population growth in the United States was now coming from immigration, and called for immigration to be balanced, that there would be no more immigration allowed in the United States from any source that was more than what we were losing in people going to other countries. In other words, it was an effort to keep the United States the same population it was. And this was not just a position of the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, Audubon Society, and others pretty much had the same position. But in the early 1990s, more politically correct type folks became involved in the population committee of the Sierra Club and other groups, and they decided that it was wrong to really restrict immigration in any way. And so that old policy was thrown out, and with it, I felt, was the only way to manage population growth in the United States.
Well, I just did a program about this book of essays on population called Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation. Yeah, you have a good essay in there.
Yes, and I have my own book called Man Swarm and the Killing of Wildlife on Overpopulation.
And after we did the program, we got some email and blog comments, not all of them complimentary. For example, Brandy was disappointed I raised the immigration issue at all. She thinks humans are the same all over the world, so what does it matter if some of them move around? What would be your response?
Well, the fact is that people don't have the same impact all over the world. And in fact, folks from the United States and Canada have a much greater impact than people anywhere else because of our wasteful lifestyles and our energy waste and all that. And the research from a number of reputable sources show that when people come to the United States or to Canada, their consumption and their overall impact goes up. Also, for example, it was shown for quite a while that immigrants to the United States from Latin America, the women were actually having a higher birth rate in the United States than those who had stayed behind in Mexico and Central America and other countries. And so it's not the same all over the world. And I think that if the United States and Canada can't manage population growth, then how can we talk to other countries about the need to manage population growth? And then finally, by the United States and Canada allowing high immigration rates, we act sort of as the safety valve on a pressure cooker, where places like Honduras have an incredible population growth rate, can send their excess population, which just encourages them not to do anything about trying to control their population growth. And there's nothing at all among responsible immigration management advocates that is against immigrants as people or against any kind of group of people in the world. It's simply a recognition that we have to take some responsibility for the population growth in our countries.
Well, what immigration solutions do you offer in your book, Man Swarm and the Killing of Wildlife?
In many ways, the United States receives many immigrants from Mexico, which is a country I've spent quite a bit of time in and have many friends in. I've done conservation work down there in cooperation with my friends there. But I think we've created a mess in Mexico through the North American Free Trade Agreement, which harmed Mexican agriculture very badly, to the extent that Mexican farmers growing corn or chickens cannot compete with the subsidized corn and chickens coming into Mexico from the United States. And so we don't just have poor campesinos thinking about moving to the United States. We have fairly prosperous middle-class and upper-middle-class farm owners and managers and chicken production companies and that type of thing being knocked out of jobs and thinking about coming to the United States. So I think we need to change NAFTA, first of all, so that Mexico can compete much better with the United States and Canada insofar as key crops like chicken and corn goes. In fact, I would say it's to our best interest, as well as to the best interests of Mexico, for Mexico to be able to outcompete the United States in the production of chickens and corn, at least in Mexico, if not for export. I mean, what we need to be doing is trying to get Mexico on its feet so it's a middle-class, middle-income country. The other big thing we can do is that our sort of chowder-headed war on drugs has created a social breakdown and a legal breakdown in Mexico. And so I think the best thing that can be done there and to deal with the takeover of Mexico by narco traffickers is for marijuana and cocaine to be decriminalized in the United States, to be taxed, and that would break the back of the narco cartels.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.